Bullock. It's really good to be here. I love this. This is a clubhouse. Is that what this is? This is absolutely phenomenal. A group of alcoholics this size and a place like this. I'm really enjoying myself in North Carolina, and you know, I want to thank everybody for being so welcoming to me when I came down here. The last couple of weeks, we did like a little bit of an intro. You know, we talked about a few things. Doctor's opinion last week. This week, what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about Bill's story. Now, just to qualify a little bit about my knowledge of Bill Wilson. You know, I became very, very interested in Alcoholics Anonymous history, and especially the co-founders and the early groups and what was going on in the first, say, decade of the formation of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was very, very interesting for me. I truly believed that my life had been saved because of AA, the fellowship, and the recovery principles. I really believed that. So it interested me to see where this came from. And I paid attention for several years at least. I paid real strict attention to some of the historical studies that were going on. There's been a number of books written about Bill Wilson. There's probably at least half a dozen that are easily available. And I've read all those. There's some conference-approved history that I've certainly read. And then there's some non-conference-approved history that's out there. And I find the non-conference approved history very, very interesting. The more you compare the two, the conference approved from the non-conference approved, the more you see that, you know, they're telling you the good stuff in the conference approved literature, and you know, there's some dark sides of AA history too. And I, for one, you know, have no problem with our co-founders not being saints. It actually makes me feel a little bit more comfortable being in Alcoholics Anonymous to know that, you know, some of the earlier founders of Alcoholics Anonymous had feet of clay. Because I don't know about anybody else. I was talking about this with somebody before the meeting. I didn't come in here to be perfect, and I don't even know that I like perfect people. Think about it. Do you know anybody that's perfect? You don't even want to be around somebody. Like, sometimes it's our imperfections that make us lovable, you know. And certainly, I think that's the way it is with my perception of the earlier, the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now Bill Wilson, basically Bill Wilson's story was that he was a World War I vet. He came back from World War I. He moved to New York City. And, you know, he went to law school. He was going to be a lawyer. But this is very alcoholic. He gets right to the last exam and stops and decides, the law's not for me. Is there anybody else in here relate to, you know, changing your mind, you know, right? You know, like, well, yeah, you know, I went to school for 4 years, but, you know, that last week, yeah. I mean, that's so perfectly alcoholic to change his mind like that. And, you know, he was meeting people from Wall Street. I spent the first 20 years of my sobriety less than an hour away from Manhattan. I've sponsored a lot of people who were money managers in New York City, and I understand the mentality and the climate pretty well from being that close to it. There are good times in the financial industries, and there are bad times in the financial industries. We're going through a bad time right now. I'd say a third of the money managers in Manhattan have been laid off, downsized, pushed out, and it's a really down time. But during up times, idiots can make a fortune. You know what I mean? You can be dumb as a bag of hammers, and you can make $1 million. You know, during the good times. And Bill kind of landed in Manhattan during one of the good times. There was money moving around, and you know, he got caught up in this, and he loved to do a lot of his business in the bars. Does that ring a bell with anybody? I don't know about you, but I got a lot of business stuff, not really done, but thought about in the bar. I started a lot of businesses, you know, sitting on the bar stool that I never started. I came up with a lot of great ideas on the bar stool that I never implemented, you know. That's kind of the way it was with Bill. But he came up with a couple of ways to part you with your money. And one of them was that he would tell you about really good stock deals. And if you were to give him the money, he would invest it for you, pretty much guaranteeing you're going to make a lot of money, and he'll take a percentage of what you make. He was a stock speculator. And during good times, you know, 9 stocks out of 10 were going up in value. So he was making some decent money. Now, that's okay during a good time. But his drinking was catching up with him. I'll read a little bit out of the story, the things that I relate to. There's a Bill's story exercise that I'd like to share with everybody tonight. One of my spiritual advisors had me do this, and I got a lot of value out of it. The first 8 pages of Bill's story is basically, you know, what it was like, what his drinking was like. So what you do is you highlight anything in the first 8 pages that you relate to as far as drinking, thinking, or behavior. This is a Bill story exercise. And it's a way of identifying a little bit with Bill. When I first read Bill's story, I read it in a treatment center. And the first thing I thought was, what a loser. You know what I mean? The guy's wife is working. It doesn't even look like he's back to work yet. You know, I mean, I was reading this with, you know, very prejudiced eyes. I didn't know how to read this story. What Bill's story really is, and one of the reasons why I think it's in the beginning of the book, is it's a beautiful example of a 12-step call in print. It talks about what it's like, what happened, and what it's like today in a very well-balanced way. And it's a beautiful example of what they would do when they would do 12-step calls at the hospitals and stuff. They would tell their story in much the same way that Bill's story is laid out. So anyway, you highlight anything that you personally relate to from your own experience, drinking, thinking, behavior, in the first 8 pages. The second 8 pages, you look at what Bill did to recover. It's pretty specific, like what he did to recover. And you highlight anything that you have resistance to. This is a good first step exercise. It's a good identification exercise. But anyway, I'm going to read just bits and pieces from this. This is on page 3. My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The complaints of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. There were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity for loyalty to my wife. Helped at times by extreme drunkenness kept me out of those scrapes. Most of the stuff in this book is true. You know, most of the statements that Bill makes are accurate. I have an issue with this one. I think maybe extreme drunkenness kept him out of some scrapes. When he got sober, it was a whole different ballgame, unfortunately. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day and often 3, got to be routine. Does anybody know what bathtub gin is? It's basically grain alcohol with distilled water and... what the heck did they put in it? I forget. It's like pine needles.
Pine salt.
Pine salt. Anyway, it's god awful stuff. It'll take the tar off the bumpers of your car. That stuff. But this is during Prohibition and stuff, and you could get alcohol. You could get straight alcohol for different purposes. It's just kind of tough to drink the straight alcohol. So he'd make the bathtub gin. Sometimes a small deal would net me a few $100s, and I would pay my bills at the bars and the delicatessens. This went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin, followed by half a dozen bottles of beer, would be required if I was to eat any breakfast. Now, again, in this book, you hear about very low-bottom alcoholics. Bill was a real low-bottom alcoholic. And most of the first 100 were really low-bottom alcoholics. And low-bottom alcoholic, what I mean by that is they went down the scale really far. They'd lost practically all power, choice, and control over the drink, and they were really physically addicted. And they would get so drunk that they would go into withdrawals. Only about 15% of alcoholics experience delirium tremens, like Bill experienced. Only about 15% get that bad, because there is a progression in alcoholism. Most of these first 100 were people who had experienced the delirium tremens, because he was pulling them out of hospitals, and they were in the hospitals to detox. So, another warning. If you're an alcoholic that's gotten to the point where you experience this really violent withdrawal, the delirium tremens, understand that you need to be medically detoxed, because 15% of the people that experience DTs die from them. So you don't want to be one of those statistics. Now, it talks about things that get worse. Things that get worse and worse and worse. I don't know that I was as low bottom an alcoholic as Bill. Now, I needed to be medically detoxed, but that was relatively late. That was in the last several years of my drinking. I think Bill went through about 10 years of drinking where he was experiencing the DTs. That's a horrific on one's physical condition. Now, it says here, I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. This happened to Bill all the time. He was through forever. He saw that the first drink would get him drunk. Okay? That slogan, that advice, that wisdom teaching that you hear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is very, very true, but it is not a defense against getting drunk. Knowing that you shouldn't get drunk is not a defense against getting drunk. Knowing that the first drink will get you drunk is not a defense against taking that first drink and getting drunk. Unfortunately, it's one of the most misunderstood parts of alcoholism. So many people think we're making a conscious choice to get drunk one more time. We even think it. But it's not true. Okay, it's an obsession. An obsession is a thought that overrides all other thoughts. It goes to the front of the line, and there's nothing we can really say about it until we have what's known as a spiritual awakening, a personality change sufficient to overcome alcoholism, that complete rearrangement of ideas, thoughts, and attitudes that they talk about in this book. So Bill is learning this hard lesson on step one. He is deciding not to drink. He's writing pledges in his Bible. He's pledging to his wonderful wife Lois. Lois, I swear on my soul, I will never do this again. I'm finished for good. You can see his Bible if you go up to Stepping Stones or the Wilson House. You'll see a copy of the Bible with these promises in there, but they never were promises that he could keep. He couldn't keep them because he didn't have the power, the choice, or control over whether he put alcohol back in his body again, because he was in a place called powerless. And he's learning this lesson in his story here. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. You know, I've listened to a lot of Bill Wilson tapes. In his tapes, he tells his story. It was called the bedtime story. Everybody joked about Bill. You know, whenever Bill would show up at an AA meeting that he normally didn't go to, everybody would go, Bill, tell the bedtime story. And they all wanted him to tell the story of the foundation of AA and meeting Ebby and, you know, the whole thing. And it was called the bedtime story because toward the end of, you know, end of Bill's life, it would take him about 2.5 hours to tell it, and everybody would be asleep by the end. Listen, every word out of his mouth was phenomenal, but he talked like this. Well, you know, my name is Bill. And he just would put you to sleep. Here we go. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. You know, this is one of the last drunks. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. Anybody ever have that sense of impending calamity? It's usually because calamity is impending. You know, if you drank anything like me. I hardly dared cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely... He was afraid to cross the street. He was in such delirium. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My reading nerves were stilled at last. And then he talks about how the stock market crashed. Okay, he's in the middle of the stock market. Now, he went from maybe putting a deal together that would net him a couple of $100 every few months to nothing. Literally the last several years, his wife worked at a department store making maybe $10 a week or whatever you made back then, and that kind of kept them going. All right, he's going in and out of town's hospital, and he's learning some stuff. He's getting involved with hydrotherapy and mild exercise and belladonna treatments and all this stuff in town's hospital. But he's learning some things from Dr. Silkworth. And here he says, it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. This again is... This is the thing that so many people misunderstand. People in Alcoholics Anonymous misunderstand it. Especially in the treatment industry, for addiction treatment, they misunderstand it. Counselors that counsel you for alcoholism misunderstand it. Certainly our families and neighbors and everybody misunderstand it. They don't understand that this is a lack of power, choice, and control. It's very, very difficult to understand powerlessness unless you have experienced it. If you've personally experienced it, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, you don't. And a lot of times in AA, there are people who've experienced this desperate hopelessness. I absolutely want to stop drinking. I'll do anything to stop drinking. I'll sign myself into treatment. You know, I'll take the pledge. I'll go back to the AA group. I'll do whatever I need to do. I absolutely want to separate from booze. And you find you can't. Once you've experienced that, you know what powerless means. There are people who treat us for alcoholism. There are people who counsel us for alcoholism. There are sponsors who sponsor us in AA who don't understand powerlessness experientially. And they expect you to just toe the line. You know? How could you have drank on me? You know what I mean? You know what I mean? How could you have not? I work with a lot of treatment centers. It's one of the things that I do for a living. And I remember sending somebody to this treatment center, and the individual drank while in treatment and got thrown out. Now think about this. Okay, think about this for a minute. I'm sending somebody who is powerless over alcohol to a treatment center that's going to charge them $15,000 a month to treat their alcoholism. And because they manifest the exact symptom I'm asking this treatment center to treat them for, they get thrown out. Think about that. If you were going to a cancer, you're going to cancer treatment, and your cancer flared back up, what do you think you'd do if they said, oh, your cancer's back, you're going to mess with our numbers, you got to go. You know what I mean? So I got back a hold with this treatment center. I go, what the hell is the matter with you? You want me to send you people that are well? You know what I mean? Is that what you want? You want me to send you alcoholics that aren't drinking anymore? I thought you were going to treat this guy. And that they didn't understand what I was saying. But he drank. Of course he drank. He's an alcoholic. Maybe I'll just send you disco drunks from now on. You know what I mean? God. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. Okay, it was now explained to him that he's got his willpower doesn't work really well with alcohol. So now, like a lot of newcomers or a lot of people that you sponsor early on, they're like, well, thanks for the information. I got it now. You know, I'm powerless. Okay, now that I know I'm powerless, I won't drink. That ain't how it works. Knowing is the booby prize in AA. You know what I mean? The only thing that's going to help you is a spiritual recovery process that will lead to a complete transformation in your personality and spiritual condition. So, again, knowing that the first drink will get you drunk and knowing that you're powerless over alcohol is not a defense against the next drink. And Bill finds that out. It was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. And then it was really, really bad. Bill basically knew that he was going to die soon. Most of the time at Towns Hospital, it says that they're loath to tell you the truth. Like, you're a hopeless alcoholic and you're gonna drink yourself to death. So, you know, pick out a coffin, make sure that the life insurance is paid up, and you know, good luck. You know, I mean, that's a lot of times what you would get from Towns. So he was at that point where he could tell by the looks of the doctors that, you know, he was one of those guys that just wasn't going to make it. Now, the great thing about Bill was, you know, he just didn't want to give up. He didn't want to give up. He was hanging on to life. He was looking. He desperately wanted to find a solution. Now, it says in here, then came the insidious insanity of the first drink on Armistice Day. Here's what happened with Bill on Armistice Day. I've heard this from his story on tape. He had been sober a while. One of the last drunks just scared the hell out of him. And like some of us, we can stay sober for a period of time. A couple of months, you know, 6 months, sometimes a year, sometimes more. Well, he was on like a two-month sober period where he just was so scared that he was able to stay away from booze. And he decided that there was no work, but, you know, he was going to go play golf. So he went down to the golf course and he went into a bar. He wasn't going to have a drink. And he sat in the bar and he was going to have some food or something. And he chats up the bartender. And he starts telling the bartender about his story. He goes, you know, bartender, I'm an alcoholic. And let me tell you a little bit about my life. And he tells him a little bit about his story, about how awful it was, about how he would go through these horrific detoxes, about the suffering and the pain that he would go through, and how he couldn't get away, couldn't separate from this alcohol, and how it just tore him to hell. And he was explaining the times that he's been in treatment and all this, and you know how horrible it is. And the bartender's like looking at him like, whoa, that's really bad. And then Bill goes, double bourbon. And the bartender looked at him like, Are you crazy? After what you just told me, you're going to put alcohol back in your body? And Bill goes, yeah, I guess I'm crazy. Make that a triple. You know, and he started drinking. Now think about that. Think about that. He was very, very aware of what alcohol did to him. He kept his memory green. He was sharing his story with a bartender about how awful it was. And at the end of that story, he ordered a triple bourbon. Now, if that isn't an example of powerlessness, I don't know what is. You know, if we can't make a decision to stay away from booze and have that mean anything, that's what a hopeless alcoholic is. And that's where Bill Wilson was at this point in time. Now, that's the first 8 pages. Near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen with a certain satisfaction. I reflected that there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of the bed. I would need it before daylight. This guy had to drink pretty much round the clock because he would go into withdrawals. All of a sudden, the telephone rang, and it's Ebby Thatcher. Ebby was exposed to the Oxford Group through Roland Hazard and this guy Shep Cornell. He had a choice of going to jail or going with the Oxford Groupers. So he said, I'll go with the Oxford Groupers. And I talked a little bit about the Oxford Group over the last couple of weeks. They were an evangelical Christian organization where they got you really busy. They were strong fellowship. They dragged you in, and every single night they had something for you to do. And there was a lot of spiritual activity. There was a lot of personal work that you did with other Oxford Group members that brought about spiritual growth. And if you participated in this at a certain level, what it did was it apparently offered you protection from the first drink. It changed you in such a fundamental way that you now had access to the power, the choice, and the control that you didn't have if you didn't participate in the Oxford Group. So all of a sudden, Ebby Thatcher shows up. Bill and Ebby had been drinking buddies. He basically sits down and he does a 12-step number on Bill. Now Bill is drinking. He's not really happy about this religious thing, you know, because Ebby basically says to him, "Bill, I got religion." I don't know about anybody else, but that wasn't my favorite three words, you know, when I was drinking. If somebody came by, you know, "I've got religion." "Well, I've got the door for you." You know what I mean? It's basically what I would say. But anyway, you know, they were old buddies, so Bill let him rant on. But he started to glimpse a little bit of the freedom, a little bit of the spiritual condition of his buddy. Hey, Ebby was a worse drunk than Bill was at certain periods of time. And Bill is looking at this guy. And you know how when the lights are on with somebody, like if you sponsor, you know, you'll get somebody through a fifth step, or they'll go out and they'll do a whole bunch of amends, and all of a sudden the light's on. You know, there's somebody home upstairs for the first time in a very long time. Well, that's what Bill was. Bill was looking at Ebby and he's saying, you know, this guy's different, man. This guy's healed. There's something really going on. He's got self-confidence. He looks really healthy. You know, there's no manifestation of fear or uncomfortability in this guy. And that caught his attention. That made him wonder what the heck was going on. Now Bill drank again, but Ebby had kind of placed himself into Bill's life. Remember this as Alcoholics Anonymous members. In the early days, they went after people who they saw needed this. It, you know, one of the things that you hear in AA a lot that gets misunderstood is it's a program of attraction, not promotion. It's not a program of attraction, not promotion. Our public relations policy is attraction, not promotion. We are very much about promotion. Okay, we're supposed to be out there promoting the hell out of this thing. We're supposed to be going to the detoxes, the treatment centers, the rehabs, the insane asylums, the prisons. We're supposed to be promoting this like crazy. Our public relations policy is attraction, not promotion. So anyway, what happens was he came to pass along his experience if I cared to have it. I was shocked but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. He talks about, I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Okay, but what he didn't believe is he was agnostic. Now, I believe what the difference between an atheist and agnostic, this is my own personal opinion. An atheist is somebody that absolutely denies the existence of God. You know, this is science. You know, this is all a cosmic accident. There's no God. That's an atheist. An agnostic is somebody that doesn't know for sure. They can believe very much in a God. They just don't have the knowledge to be able to say absolutely for sure anything. And that's really what an agnostic is. Ag meaning no, gnosis meaning knowledge, agnostic. Now, Bill was an agnostic. He had had spiritual experiences before. He had one in the Winchester Cathedral one time while he was over in Europe during the war. He had had those feelings. I think we've all had those feelings. It's a feeling of connection with the world at a deep level. You know, it's a spiritual experience. And he had had those. And I think we've all had those. I had some of them when I was doing LSD. I don't know about anybody else. But, you know, just being right with the world, you know. And, wow! Does anybody remember wow? So he wasn't an atheist. He didn't take absolutely for granted what the religious people were saying. He couldn't buy into that. He couldn't buy into any of the party line. But he knew that something was going on. Now, my friend sat before me and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Now, Bill understood that at a deep level. Bill understood that lack of power, choice, and control. And he knew Ebby was an alcoholic too. Now, Ebby had found something. He had found power, choice, and control, and he had found it somehow. That's what got Bill's attention. That's what allowed Bill to say, I think I want this thing. Tell me a little bit more. And as 12-steppers, that's what we need to do too when we're talking with alcoholics, when we're trying to draw alcoholics in to the Alcoholics Anonymous process. You know, what we want to do is we want to identify with them so that they know we have felt and been where they are. And we're not there anymore. You know, that's the best message that we can have as 12-steppers. And that's what Ebby did with Bill. Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute, and that was none at all. I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped new soil. Now, still Bill had a little bit of resistance. You understand that alcoholic resistance? I mean, you know, how many years did we suffer pretty much because of our resistance to this thing? You know, nobody goes, hey, here's the number for AA in the phone book. I think I'll go in and, you know, do my best in there. I mean, that's just not what happens. We come in here fussing and pushing and fighting and you know, arguing. We're really not happy to be here. That's really what happens with us. So Bill is still a little bit, you know, this God thing. I understand the power. I understand there's some power. You have some power. But this God thing. And Ebby got mad. Now, there's two stories. There's Bill's story. And you got to remember, he's drinking bathtub gin. So he may not be remembering this really well. And then there's Ebby's story. And I've heard Ebby's story. There's tapes of Ebby telling this story. And he tells a different story. He tells a story that he got pissed off at Bill and started yelling at him. Okay. You've got all these problems with God. Why don't you just make up your own conception of God? Make God into whatever the hell you want it to be. And that's basically what he did. And that opened the door for Bill to be able to accept a spiritual recovery process. Now, it talks in this book about what's definitely going to defeat us. What'll defeat us is belligerent denial. What'll defeat us is unreasoning prejudice. What'll defeat us is an absolute refusal to have an open mind on spiritual matters. That will defeat us in Alcoholics Anonymous if we're an alcoholic. So there needs to be an open mind on these. What opened Bill's mind was the conception that he could make up his own conception of God. That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required to make my beginning. And that's the way it is with us too. I really believe that. We just need to be willing. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Thus, I was convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want Him enough. Now, I'm absolutely convinced. I've had spiritual teachers who have ripped away every vestige of me thinking I've done this myself. You know, if I'm going up to get a shift, and somebody yells out, "How'd you do it?" My first thought is, I didn't. You know what I mean? Without the power of God, I would not be standing here sober. However, we need to cooperate. We need to participate in our own recovery, because there's certain things God will do, but there's certain things that we have to turn our self-will over. The story I like to tell about self-will is this. It goes back to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve are running around. They're partying it up. There's food everywhere. They're running around naked. They're having an absolute blast, okay? And God just tells them, look, I just got one rule for you. There's a tree over there, a tree of self-knowledge, a tree of self-centeredness. And I don't want you to go near there, because that's just going to blow your whole worldview up. And that's just going to be a really bad thing. So, you know, I want you to enjoy paradise, so stay away from that tree. What happens? You know, maybe Adam was an alcoholic. Who knows? Wow, if God doesn't want me to have that, it's got to be really good, you know? So they eat of the apple. They both eat of the apple. Now God shows back up in the garden and sees them, and they've covered themselves with fig leaves. They've got all kinds. Now they've got self-centered fear, and they have anxiety, and you know, they're like all shy and uncomfortable. And God figures it out. He goes, You ate of the tree, didn't you? I told you not to do that. Now, God loved them so much that He said, okay, if you want self-will that much, you can have it. You know, you've shown yourself to want to be self-centered and to have self-will. That's fine. You can have that. But you can't stay in Eden. You can't stay in paradise. You got to go east of Eden to the land of Nod. Anybody in here ever been to the land of Nod? You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, you can do whatever you want in the land of Nod, but it gets pretty bleak after a while. Okay, you start drooling on yourself, and you start calling people on the phone drunk, and you start piling up the DUIs and being misunderstood by everybody. That's the land of Nod. Now, here's the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. We can get back into paradise. We just have to come back and turn our self-will in at the door. And we need to now have a will to align ourselves with what God would have us be and what God would have us do. And we can get back into paradise. I think recovery is paradise. It's shown itself to be that for me. Now, but this doesn't come easy. We are a tough crowd. You know, we got some resistance. You ever work with, like, newcomers? You know, I was working with one, you know, really trying. Hey, if you do this, there'll be a good outcome. If you do this, there'll be a good outcome. If you do this, there'll be a good outcome. Well, you know, I think I'll hook up with a chick and go across the country. All right. Okay. Let me know how that works for you. How long are you sober? 84 days. Okay. Maybe she's the one that really understands you. Maybe she's Mrs. Wright. Maybe she's God's will for you. You know, maybe she's got relapse tattooed on her forehead. What's the matter with you? Anyway. Okay, here is a great thing. This is page 13. And I want to go over this because it's so important. And we miss this when we go over this. It's so important. At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. This is when they start shoving belladonna down his throat and some other psychoactive ingredients that helped with detox. Nowadays, you get Librium, you get Ativan, and you get some decent, you know, detox medication. Back then, all they had was belladonna, which is like a weed that you get like in the backyard that's like poisonous. So, you know, it was really a tough detox. Basically, the belladonna was given to you so that you would vomit continuously. They thought, well, if he vomits continuously, he'll get rid of all that poison in it. You know, blah, blah. You know, so for about 3 days, you know, retching and vomiting. So You got to take in context what's going on, where he was at. In treatment, Ebby came back and visited him. It says here, there I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch. I've not had a drink since. Let's look at that. That really is a great surrender. That's a great first, second, and third step. And it's also a good sixth and seventh step. When you look at it, you know, being facing your sins, facing your character defects, and being willing to have God remove them. My schoolmate visited me. Ebby Thatcher shows up, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. This is a fifth step. This is a confessional, the Oxford Group confessional process. We made a list of people that I had hurt or toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability. This is him doing an eighth step list, preparing to, when he leaves the hospital, do a ninth step. Now, I'll tell you what, the treatment centers, most of them aren't even called treatment centers, they're called recovery centers. The places that I support really strongly, personally out there, that are taking us in for treatment, of alcoholism. The places I really support are the recovery centers that really try to do a lot of this step work with you. The good ones, when you leave, you have a list or you have index cards with all of your amends, and they are going to help you through the aftercare process, go out and actually make direct amends to the people you've harmed. This is right after treatment or the recovery process. Those are the places I support. They have the highest outcomes of any treatment centers, those recovery centers that get you to do that. Here's a statistic for you. 5 years after alcoholism treatment, 5% of the people are going to still be sober. 5 years after doing a fifth step, 60% of the people will still be sober. Think about that. So I support the people who help you through this process. We need some counseling, we need some therapy, we need to have a little bit of our head shrunk, you know, sure. We need to deal with our issues, we need to deal with some issues. But the thing that offers us protection from the next drink is the spiritual awakening. The spiritual awakening. We have to work for that. It can't be taught to us. We can't pick it up in a lecture. You know, what we need to do is we need to work for it. And this is what Bill is doing and preparing to do on his detox bed in the hospital. Think about that. He's gone through the first 8 steps and he isn't even out of his detox bed. Think about that. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. This is great 10th and 11th step stuff. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. You know how newcomers have problems and issues? I mean, it's like constant drama. Sometimes as a sponsor, you feel like a drama coach. You know, because you get a phone call. Oh, I blew my life up this way today. You know? You know what I mean? Well, when you're agitated, when you're doubtful, when you don't know which way you should go, you don't just do something, you stand there. Okay, it's the opposite of what we're programmed to do. Don't just do something, stand there. Pause when agitated or doubtful. Ask for the direction and strength to meet your problems as God would have you meet them. These are really extraordinarily powerful exercises for us to use, for us to teach our sponsees, our protégés, our prospects how to use them. You know, one of the things that I see in Alcoholics Anonymous today that I think is very hurtful is there are groups that demand group loyalty and sponsors that demand sponsor authority. So the sponsor is absolutely in charge of every single thing in your life. Whether you go back to college, who you date, who you marry, you know, what kind of car you drive, when you buy a car. I mean, you know, they're involved in the minutia of your life. That's not what this book is pointing us toward. This book is pointing us toward having direction from God, not from human power, from divine power. This is not a self-help program. This is a divine help program. It's much bigger than so many of us give it credit for. Never was I to pray for myself except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. My friend promised that when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. Okay, let's look at that sentence. Ebby told him that when these things were done, when these steps were done, he would enter upon a new relationship with his Creator and that he would have a way of living that answered all of his problems, not just his alcohol problem. That's an incredible promise. That's really talking about some serious power. And, you know, so often we settle for relief instead of the freedom and the power that's available in this program. What has happened in Alcoholics Anonymous is in a lot of areas, I'm not talking about here, this is a pocket of enthusiasm. I'm you know, this is choir practice, I understand that. But there are places in Alcoholics Anonymous where it's become a fellowship-based sobriety. And they've gotten away from a program-based recovery. The real freedom, the real power, the real change, the real quality of life comes from a program-based recovery and not a fellowship-based sobriety. Belief in the power of God plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Let's all remember what those simple requirements were. Simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. Remember I said that we're coming back to Eden and we're turning our self-will in at the door because we're tired of the land of Nod? I must turn in all things to the Father of Light who presides over us all. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory, followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of the mountaintop blew through and through. I mean, the wind of the Spirit was blowing up this guy's butt. You know what I mean? This was a serious spiritual awakening for him. It happened sudden and profound. It talks about in the spiritual appendix in here that the spiritual awakening, spiritual experience can happen in a sudden and profound way like it did with Bill, or it can happen slowly through the educational variety. Slowly through the educational variety is usually that happens to most of us because we slowly, you know, integrate these spiritual exercises into our life. We don't want to jump into anything that's going to heal us too quick, you know. You know, wait, I got to get my head out of my butt before I do those steps, you know. My friend emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. Listen to this sentence, okay? Anybody in here ever heard, it's a selfish program? I gotta be selfish. Sign me up! You know, it's a selfish program. Sign me up! Listen to this sentence. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. All right. If we don't put the welfare of others ahead of ourselves at certain times in our life, if we don't develop an attitude of charity, an attitude of service, a service ethic, trying to help out people who are a little bit less off than us. If we don't develop that, we are not going to make it through the trials and the low spots ahead. There's an article that was just written in the Wired magazine. And, you know, that's been going around through emails. Anybody here read it? Google it. You know, it's a pretty good article. Anyway, it talks about the success rates in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're terrible. They're terrible. You know, 80% of the people that walk through the door of AA aren't here a year later. I mean, you know, that's a terrible success rate. And it really does reflect on us. Now, there's a lot of reason for that. A lot of non-alcoholics come through. A lot of people who still have some power, choice, and control. And they find that just with a little encouragement, with a little self-knowledge, they can not drink. And they don't really need all these meetings and all this intensity. You know, that's fine. There are a lot of those people, and they cycle through. But the alcoholics who come in here and relapse, you ask them, you know, did you work and did you self-sacrifice for others while you were trying to get sober? No. They told me it was a selfish program. I never did nothing for nobody. You know? Well, you're not supposed to stay sober then. You're supposed to get drunk. There's a lot of things that if you don't do, you're supposed to get drunk. Another thing you hear all the time is that, you know, there's no musts in AA. There's a ton of musts if you want to recover. There's a lot of musts. And if you don't do the musts, you know, your chances are less than average. What is less than average? That's less than 50%. And that's what I've seen. That's what I've seen true. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. If he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. An alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. Our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic, and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. Bill Wilson, you know, Bill learned a lot of lessons about how to 12-step. You know, he didn't immediately know exactly how to do this. He made a huge amount of mistakes. He was pulling people off of bar stools who didn't even want to quit drinking. You know, has anybody ever done that? I mean, when I first got into AA and I got evangelical, I went back after a bunch of my drinking buddies and, oh, you should try AA. It's really great. There's cookies and coffee. We don't drink and we hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer. A lunacy commission was appointed. Anyway, Bill got busy. He dedicated his entire life to this. Lois was working at the department store, you know. She was making the money. So he was running around, hooking up with drunks and doing 12-step work. He was a 12-step working fool, you know. And then he meets up with Dr. Bob, who also became a 12-step working fool. Dr. Bob, a conservative estimate on how many people he took through the steps, either at the hospital, at his office, or at his house, is about 5,000 people. Okay, he only lived 15 years into AA. So do the math. How many times does 5,000 go into 365 times 15? It'll figure out that he was taking about 3 people through the steps every day. You know, Dr. Bob didn't fool around. He brought you into his office and he said, "Kid, do you believe in God? Well, get out on your knees." And he'd get you down and, "Now, turn your will and your life over to God." And you go, "Okay, I turn my will. That's not good enough. Let me hear it again." You know, and he would push you through the steps in an afternoon. There's a story in here of a guy he did that to. I forget which story it is, but it's in the first series of stories, and he goes through the whole thing, exactly what Dr. Bob did with him, you know. There was a guy, this wonderful drunk, Clarence Snyder, who was such a character. He's the individual who started the Cleveland group, AA group number 3. And he was a very charismatic, very high power individual. And he actually turned the Cleveland AA group into the biggest AA group in a very short period of time, just because he was just a powerful individual. And he was sent from New York to Dr. Bob in Akron, Ohio, to be cured of alcoholism. Somebody had heard that Dr. Bob was curing alcoholics, so they gave Clarence Snyder a one-way ticket to Dr. Bob. And as he's walking up to Dr. Bob's office, he sees the sign: Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith, proctologist. Okay, he goes, "Well, that's something I haven't tried yet." You know? and he tells the story. He tells the story of going in and, you know, and having Dr. Bob brutalize him through the steps, and then immediately get him working with others. There were some periods of time in AA where there was huge growth spurts. Publication of certain articles all of a sudden exposed the world to this Alcoholics Anonymous thing. The Saturday Evening Post article, the Liberty Magazine article. And what happened was, all of a sudden, AA gets this really positive PR. And there were groups with like 10 people who got hundreds of phone calls of people who wanted to be new members. So what would happen is there would be 10 people in a group and they would have to take 200 people through the steps. And they started to learn how to do it. That's where some beginners meetings started to become developed. That's where some structure to taking people through the steps started to happen in early Alcoholics Anonymous. Make no mistake about it. In early AA, it was a program with a support fellowship. It was not a fellowship with maybe a support program. Here's what it would look like in the first decade of AA. There would be a meeting, say, on Monday night, where all the alcoholics would get together. And they would strategize about where they were going to go to find prospects. And what they would do is they would strategize. And some people would go to the hospital on Monday. Some people would go to the insane asylum on Monday. On Tuesday, some people would go to the prison. Some people would go to some doctors and some clinics. You know, all through the week they would go and they would get prospects. They would get prospects to take through the steps. Over the weekend, they'd take them through the steps. And then Monday night, they'd meet with them. And the people who had gone through the steps are strategizing about where they're going to go to look for new members for Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a very powerful, very intense process. It's not how we do it today. And you know, there's some wisdom. There's some wisdom in taking a little bit of time. But that's how there was a sense of urgency back in those days about getting through the steps and getting to the place where you were helping other alcoholics, because they were absolutely convinced that their sobriety was 100% contingent on how much work with other alcoholics they were going to be doing. And it showed, because the people that backed off, the people that said, you know, I've been doing a lot of work lately, you know, I really got to get some balance back in my life, you know, those are the people who ended up relapsing. So, anyway, that's all for tonight. Next week, we're going to really start getting into it. We're going to start getting into the chapters on step one. That's a lot of fun. I have a lot of fun with those chapters. So I hope I'll see you all back here next week.